This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of January 23rd, here are some top stories. In the news, there is a lawsuit pending based on a form of profiling. Here's the story from KJZZ's The Show.
Racial profiling by law enforcement is unconstitutional, but what about neighborhood profiling?
Neighborhood profiling is now at the center of a case before the Arizona Supreme Court, and the show's Lauren Gilger joins us to talk about it. Good morning, Lauren.
Morning, Mark. Morning, Steve.
So first off, let's start with what exactly is neighborhood profiling?
Sure. So neighborhood profiling is basically profiling people in a neighborhood based on what you think about that area, just like racial profiling is based on someone's race.
So basically saying, this isn't a nice neighborhood, we see a lot of crime here, so this person here might be a criminal.
Exactly. I spoke with Kathy Barnes more about this. She's an associate dean at the University of Arizona's law school, and she says that the biggest issue with this is it creates a cycle.
You end up with this sort of cycle of police going into neighborhoods that they think have a lot of high crime and then sort of looking only in that neighborhood for crime and then finding some, and then the next time they look for a neighborhood that has crime, they go to the same neighborhood because that's where they found it last time. And so that cycle is very destructive.
And so you would miss crime that might be happening in other areas where you may not be looking.
But if you're a police officer, you have a limited amount of resources. Isn't it smarter to focus on areas that have proven to be high crime?
Right. Well, Barnes says that it's actually tough to know where most crime happens. You just know where you find the most crime because that's where you're looking. But she says officers are really in a tough spot sometimes.
Police departments will argue correctly that they are also being asked to be in places where there's sort of high crime. And there's a balance between providing sort of extra police support to where there are crimes, where more crimes are happening, and sort of profiling or sort of going beyond just that and sort of targeting communities in more negative ways.
So, Lauren, what is this case before the state Supreme Court?
Right. So in 2012, a man named Anthony Primus was sitting outside an apartment complex in Phoenix with a group of people. When a police officer showed up, they had a federal warrant. They were searching for a suspect. And when they came, one of the men Primus was sitting with ran. Then the officer searched him and found marijuana in his pocket. So I spoke more about this case with Kathy Brody. She's the legal director of the ACLU of Arizona, and she recently argued that that was an unlawful search based on neighborhood profiling. And she thinks this case raises an important issue that could affect the civil rights of all of us here in Arizona.
Racial profiling, we know, is unconstitutional, and many courts have said that. So if, for instance, a robbery occurs and the victim of the crime says, the person who did this to me was a white woman with brunette hair. Of course, the police can go then look for this white woman, and that's not illegal racial profiling. However, the officers can't just do, for instance, what Sheriff Arpaio did and, you know, target a group of people or any individuals within that group just based on their race or ethnicity. And so our position in this case is that neighborhood profiling is just as bad because it takes the general characteristics of a neighborhood, such as violent or high crime, and unfairly places every person that happens to be in that neighborhood for whatever reason in that general category and allows increased law enforcement contact and intrusion into that person's life.
Does this disproportionately affect minorities?
It has been shown that that type of neighborhood profiling does have a disproportionate effect on people of color. And there are other dangers too of this neighborhood profiling, because it leads to this over-policing of certain neighborhoods and population, which has not just a bad effect on the individuals in those neighborhoods, but on the greater community and on society as a whole. For instance, there are documented instances that this kind of neighborhood profiling can exacerbate tensions between police and communities that end up being subject to these greater and more aggressive police presence.
So if you're trying to foster sort of a healthy relationship between law enforcement and a neighborhood where there is a lot of crime, you're saying this isn't a good way to go about it.
That's exactly right. And we're afraid that if the Arizona Supreme Court endorses the law enforcement activity in this case, it will be licensed for law enforcement to essentially set up dragnet operations in neighborhoods where they could place themselves in neighborhoods without really any suspicion of particular crime occurring, but just, you know, stopping and frisking people who happen to come upon the police operation, which could certainly further exacerbate any tensions.
That was Kathy Brody, legal director of the ACLU of Arizona. She recently argued against neighborhood profiling before the Arizona Supreme Court as part of the State versus Primus case. We also reached out to the Arizona Attorney General's office about this case, and they said they can't comment on it.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you.
President Donald Trump's executive order to build a border wall that he signed this week was vague on the details of how it would be built or if it would replace the massive border fences that already exist. From the Fronteras desk in Tucson and our Mexico City Bureau, KJZZ's Michel Marisco and Jorge Valencia report on what those plans might include and the president's impact on Mexico.
Among other details, the president promised to hire 5,000 new federal border officers and to triple the number of immigration and customs enforcement agents. But first, he promised to build a wall.
The Secretary of Homeland Security, working with myself and my staff, will begin immediate construction of a border wall.
He didn't specify what the wall would look like. Already about 650 miles of a mix of pedestrian wall, bollard-style fencing, and vehicle barrier run the length of the entire border. But 2 days before Trump took office last week, Customs and Border Protection put out the call for ideas for an elaborate system of towers to run along a broad swath of both the northern and southern borders to help spot incursions. A smaller version of the tower network already operates in southern Arizona. Nogales, Arizona Mayor John Doyle argues those existing towers are far more effective than a new wall could be.
On its own, it's really going to be more of an eyesore.
Not everyone feels that way.
My name is Jim Chilton. I'm a rancher in southern Arizona. And part of my ranch, the southern end, is the international boundary.
Chilton's ranch is separated from Mexico by barbed wire and a crooked vehicle barrier. So when Trump made the wall a cornerstone of his campaign,
I was elated. That's exactly what we need. I've been discussing that for the last 4 or 5 years.
For Chilton, Trump's promise of a wall was no metaphor. Reporting from Nogales, Arizona, I'm Michel Marisco, and here's my colleague Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
People here have been watching. First, as candidate Trump promised to build a wall, then as he was elected, and after the orders were signed, many wanted to know President Enrique Peña Nieto's position.
En respuesta, he ordenado que la Secretaría de Relaciones Exteriores...
Mexico's 50 consular offices in the U.S. will protect the rights of migrants. That's how Peña Nieto started almost 3 minutes of televised remarks last night. Dozens of politicians had called on him to cancel a visit to Washington.
Mexico ofrece y exige respeto.
Mexico gives respect and demands respect. That's about as close as Peña Nieto got to answering the question. He did reiterate that his country will not pay for the wall, but he didn't say whether he'll visit Trump. In his own remarks, Trump had sought to portray the unwelcome overture of the wall as a form of collaboration.
This will also help Mexico by deterring illegal immigration from Central America and by disrupting violent cartel networks.
What do you think of that?
It's a simplistic solution.
Jose Fernandez Santillan is a political scientist at Monterey Tech in Mexico City. He says a wall along the 2,000-mile border won't achieve Trump's stated goals. For example, he says migrants can travel by water. Or drug traffickers can imitate what drug kingpin El Chapo Guzman did for years.
Do you remember the Chapo? The Chapo dig at least 146 tunnels through the border.
One of Santillan's students reflected many people's visceral reaction to the U.S.'s plan. Helga Jauregui says she's not as worried as much about who will pay $10 billion for the wall as she is about what it represents.
It's more like this ideological thing, saying that we don't want you anymore, or we don't want, with a basis of segregation and marginalizations, and why not discrimination.
Jauregui says she grew up vacationing in New York, Washington, and Houston, but that she doesn't feel welcome to visit again. In Mexico City, I'm Jorge Valencia.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Now, let's hear a conversation from KJZZ's original production, The Show.
Movements to create social change have been going on in the U.S. since the nation got started. Recently, we've seen Occupy Wall Street and protests related to the Dakota Access Pipeline. And early decisions by the Trump administration have stirred up hundreds of thousands of people to get involved and take part in many counter-efforts. But how do we determine if a social movement has been impactful and whether it's sustainable? Jackie Kennelly is an associate professor at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada, who studies social movements. And Professor, how do we measure success in this kind of effort?
One thing we need to think about is how we are measuring success. I think success can mean a lot of different things. If we're looking at the visibility of a movement, for instance, the degree to which it sways public opinion, that could be a measure of success. If we're looking at the way in which it actually influences change, does it influence policymakers? Does it stop an event from happening? Does it make an event happen? Those are different ways of measuring success. And I think movements function at all of these different levels. And, you asked about sustainability. I think that's a really important question because often what happens is movements from the outside, they seem to come and go, they appear and they disappear. But that's really an optic of the media and how much attention the media is giving to a movement. Because often what's happening in the background is, people are busy continuing to build, they're building their networks, they're doing their organizing, they're having meetings that don't happen to be in the public eye. And then for whatever reason, convergence of events, President Trump was elected, suddenly all of those movements come together and mobilize into something that's highly visible that may in fact have many of the same people involved in the background, but look quite different, have a different name or be addressing related but slightly different issues.
Though it's early on in this because President Trump just took over, are there certain factors you'll be looking at to see the sustainability of these protests, whether they're gaining traction, whether they're actually, I don't even want to say convincing people who may disagree at this point, but at least getting more people to think about it and not have it be so reactionary to, you're getting in my way, I'm trying to go to work, this sort of thing. And actually, when it becomes the protest that people are, it makes them think when they go home.
It's really interesting, the way in which movements get taken up in the kind of popular imagination has really shifts and moves over time. And I think it's interesting, if we look back at 2011 at the Occupy movement, that was a massive surprise to everyone, I think, how much popular take-up there was, how much sympathetic coverage there was in the media. And that was happening, on the tail of a series of other massive social movements that were happening in the Middle East, the Arab Spring, etc. I don't think anyone could have predicted that the level of both popular response and media sympathy, because often the media is not very sympathetic. If we back up even farther to 2003, the largest protests up to that point in the world were massive peace mobilizations against the war in Iraq, and they hardly received any mainstream media coverage, and that coverage was very unsympathetic, such that it was. There are different moments in terms of response to these movements, and I think it remains to be seen what's going to happen. I mean, so far what I'm seeing is quite sympathetic to the movements, to the Women's March on Saturday. I think that speaks to the fact that so many people went, and everyone, or not, maybe not everyone, but a lot of people know someone who went, and they might be seeing pictures of it on their Facebook page, etc. And so it's touching a lot of people, and so that brings the media's attention, because the media are people too, of course, with friends who attend protests.
How do you think social media is starting to impact social movements, and do you think that impact will simply grow from now on?
So I think social media has played a role in movements for a long time. Obviously, we're in a particular age of digital social media, but social media, in terms of people talking to one another and sharing information, has been a part of movements since the beginning. So, you know, creating a pamphlet, handing it out, having town hall meetings, sharing information, asking people to hand it back, phone trees, you know, moving up a little bit. So once we had telephones, people phoning out to folks to give them information. So now, of course, digital social media is a different beast. It's got a broader reach. It has its own kind of configurations. But I think movements have been very adept ever since social media emerged in using it in ways that are productive for the movements, right? In spreading information, in sharing images and videos, and being able to kind of speak back to power. So I think that's going to continue. I think there's a concern also about the commercialization of social media and the corporatization of social media and the way in which advertisers with big pockets can send out their message and smother the other voices. I think that that is always a concern, and people have been fighting back against that for a long time. So, I think the role of social media is definitely an integral part of movements, but it's not the only part of movements. It's also, social media ultimately is about relationships and relationship building, and that's what really what social movements are grounded in, are relationships between people who hold each other to account, who want to see things change, who want to create a better society for everyone on the basis of those feelings of connectedness and caring in relationships ultimately.
But in the broader sense, how do we as observers know when a social movement is organic and when it's being driven by leaders who have a political agenda, whether on the right or the left?
So one thing about the term social movement is it has become quite broad, and there are movements on the right and the left. The movements I am most familiar with are grassroots movements, and if you attend a meeting of a movement, or a meeting of, you know, organizing meeting, say to try and whatever it might be, reduce police brutality, or bring particular issues to the attention of politicians, you attend that community meeting, it doesn't take long to realize that these are a group of citizens who are concerned. There are no particular driving factor. There's no kind of nefarious, like, corporate or political interest here. It's just people who are trying to get their voices heard. That's one way. You know, if you get involved with the movement, it doesn't take long to see who's driving it. I think if it's hard to get involved with the movement, if there aren't open meetings, if there aren't points of access and ways to ask questions, then that's one thing that would raise a red flag about what's going on and who's driving this.
Jackie Kennelly is an associate professor at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. We've been talking about social movements.
In business news, a battle that's been brewing over a craft beer taproom in Central Phoenix has come to a head. The owners of Huss Brewing Company want to set up shop at Central Avenue and Camelback Road. But some neighbors have been pushing back, and both sides were scheduled to present their cases before a zoning hearing officer this week. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports it's just one example of how adaptive reuse projects are changing neighborhoods.
With towering trees and green lawns surrounding single-story homes, Tony Sishin's neighborhood looks like many others in Central Phoenix. Until you walk through his backyard and open the garage door.
Right now we're standing right behind my house looking at the parking lot.
A motorcycle dealership used to be here, but now the parking lot belongs to the yard. It's home to three restaurants and a spacious courtyard featuring dining space, lounge areas, and games like ping pong, foosball, and beanbag toss. Sishin says the developer's initial sales pitch went something like this.
Just the family-friendly neighborhood eating place that the neighborhood has always wanted.
Not long after the yard opened, Sishin says it became more of a nightclub environment with noisy patrons and cars cramming into residential areas just off 7th Street. No parking signs went up, and neighbors were told to call the non-emergency police number. Sishin says it worked for about 3 months, but now he typically hears,
it may be quite a while before an officer can arrive. You know, we know what that means.
With just a narrow alley separating homes from the parking lot, Sishin says residents often encounter rude behavior.
My neighbor has teenage girls. They cannot use the trampoline in their backyard because of the catcalls they get from young men out here.
I think we learned a lot from the yard.
That's Chris Mackey, the city's economic development director.
It never is our intent to cause a challenge to a neighborhood.
She describes adaptive reuse projects as a careful balancing act between helping developers turn vacant or rundown buildings into new businesses while also respecting neighborhoods. When Phoenix approved plans for the yard more than 4 years ago, the city's parking requirements were based only on dining areas and not recreational space.
So to go back and say, well, gosh, you are going to have to close because you don't have enough parking spaces, that's something the city can't do.
There's a city code for what you're supposed to park a project, and then there's reality.
Reality, according to developer David Sellers, is that restaurants and bars really need more parking than the city requires. That's why he leases extra space from a church. Sellers' complex, called The Colony, also limits access so customers can only go in and out from 7th Street.
Because I think what happens when cars go into the neighborhood, they look to your parking lot, and if it's full, they'll just park in the neighborhood. Whereas ours, they're never going in the neighborhood whatsoever.
While 7th Street between Missouri Avenue and Bethany Home Road is arguably the city's hottest spot for new restaurants and bars, the corner of Central Avenue and Camelback Road has also seen changes. And some neighbors say enough already.
Our objection is not to Hus Brewing having a presence in Uptown Plaza. Our objection is to the location at Uptown Plaza.
During a city council meeting last month, Ken Mosesian explained why the Windsor Square Historic District opposes plans for a craft beer tap room with a patio.
The beer and wine bar will be located 34 feet from a single-family residential home and from several homes along that alleyway.
Idling delivery trucks are not new to neighbors, but the amount of noise and traffic is. Uptown Plaza brought in several new restaurants, and their success is what led Leah Huss and her husband to sign a lease there. She told council members she was shocked to hear the opposition.
We felt that we had done everything to become a good neighbor, including self-imposing restrictions on ourselves. We never imagined that 3 months after our initial announcement and tens of thousands of dollars already invested, that we would be facing real possibility of losing everything.
As Huss Brewing owners and neighbors try to work out a deal they can both live with, the city is working on new requirements. They call for future projects to include parking for recreational spaces, like the yard.
Not that that does anything for our neighborhood.
But Tony Sishin says it could help others if they get involved early.
One of the problems is that neighborhoods never become active until bad things have already happened to them.
Whenever he sees a public hearing notice posted on private property, Sishin says he reaches out to neighbors and encourages them to make it their business to find out who wants to move in. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A former University of Arizona president will lead the effort to build a ground-based telescope more powerful than the Hubble Space Telescope. From the Arizona Science Desk, Sarah Hammond reports for KJZZ.
Robert Shelton will head the Giant Magellan Telescope Organization based in Pasadena, California. He was the U of A's 19th president, serving from 2006 to 2011. He is now in charge of the Tucson-based Research Corporation for Science Advancement, which funds basic science research. The Giant Magellan Telescope's 7 primary mirrors are made at the U of A's Mirror Lab, and the university is a founding partner in the project. The telescope will be built in Chile. U of A Astronomy Department Head Buell Januzzi says Shelton has experience with major astronomy projects globally.
Robert's been involved in so many of our country's leading telescope observatories, the Keck Observatory in California. When he was at the University of North Carolina, he was involved in the development of the SOAR telescope in Chile.
After leaving the U of A, Shelton was the executive director of the Arizona Sports Foundation, which produces the Fiesta and Cactus Bowls. He is a physicist by training and will join the telescope organization February 20th. In Tucson, I'm Sarah Hammond.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Vitalist Health Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the ASU Biodesign Institute, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischmann, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fricke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information source.